That's the Passion Group, You Are My King, Amazing Love. You know it that way as well. We heard from Wayne Watson, A Beautiful Place. And good morning to you, 12 minutes after the hour on a Broken Road Radio Monday. It is a beautiful place, made that much nicer by the presence of Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist, member of the board at creationmoments.com. Don joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning to you. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave. It's
morning, Don.
It's a beautiful morning here. It's probably going to get a little warmer. Mm-hmm. It's about 70, I think it's about 71 or 72.
You know, it was just about 68 degrees all across the country when we went on the air with the morning show. I was just looking at weather all over, and just about less, that's like the average temperature, no matter what part of the country you're in. Of course, we go in different directions from there. but
yes,
kind of the standard temperature there, and we're looking at 90s today and tomorrow. So yeah, the tomatoes are going to love it. They're going to soak that up. How are the grapes doing?
Well, the white wine is almost completely fermented. It's starting to slow down now.
Mm-hmm.
I lowered the temperature to about 55 degrees, which is going to cause it to slow down, but it's also going to cause the more of the fruitiness to come out, you know, in the wine.
Okay.
So.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what causes fruitiness in wines. I would have figured it's just the kind of grapes, but I guess there's more to it than that. You can actually control the flavors to various degrees, huh? Now, we should mention to listeners that Don is also, besides being a biochemist, I keep forgetting that word. He raises grapes and makes wine. What is a vigneron?
Vigneron.
Depends upon what he's doing at the time. If he's a vigneron, that means he's out picking grapes in the vineyard.
Uh-huh.
Vineyard manager, if he's an oenophile, it means he's reading up about wine and perhaps sipping some.
Ah, okay. Well, he's an oenophile and a vigneron.
Mm-hmm. And a vintner. A vintner is the person who actually makes wine.
And a vintner.
he's the guy that actually makes it. Yep.
I'm not going to remember those words. Dr. Don, you were at a creation conference in Pittsburgh a week before last. And we talked about it somewhat last Monday. And it turns out to be, it was quite an event with multiple presentations on a great variety of subjects. All of them fascinating. How did you handle all that? I mean, could you make most of them, if not all of them?
Well, there were basically three panels going on at any one time. So there was a lot of presentations going on. So I had to be, you have to select which ones you're going to go to. So I made about a third of them.
Oh.
all of them were very interesting and intriguing. It's too bad I couldn't go to, multiple presentations at one time.
But, well, kind of give us a summary of what some of those were and then zero in on your favorite one for us.
All right. Well, there were several favorite ones that we can talk about today. There were, as we discussed last week, there were simulations, atmospheric simulations, as well as oceanic simulations as to what possible, energies and storms and tidal waves and stuff could have possibly have been involved at the time of the flood. And the one simulation with regard to the sediments of the deposits that we see around the Earth, I mean, we have tremendous sediments around the Earth, and it can't be explained by, just the simple local floods, as folks would like to do. Or even just a global flood that had minor energy input. These sediments that we see that are a couple of thousand feet in depth could have only been caused by a very, very catastrophic event.
Okay, well, I have to ask you a question in this regard then. Did the researchers on these projects start with the premise that there was a global flood, a great flood, Noah's flood we're talking about, and then look at what we have now and try to reconcile what we have now with the fact that there was a flood? Or did they look at the evidence now and say this was most likely caused by a flood? I mean, because we talk about the other side all the time, automatically ruling out the things of God. the notion of a creation. And so they only believe what they can see with their own eyes, and they draw their own conclusions independent of what we consider to be fact, that there is a God, there is a creator, and he works on his creation. Was this honest science, in your opinion?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it's coming from the point of view that the Bible is accurate and is descriptive of events that happened in the past. So, I mean, even the word Genesis, which means beginnings, but it's a chronicle of things that happened in the beginning. So if we look at it as a history book, sometimes it's quite detailed, other times it's not so detailed. But just the simple fact that there was a global flood, such a thing as a global flood, you take that into consideration, and you say, well, here's what we're seeing today in the geology. What could have possibly explained this? And so in this one case, where they were looking at sediments, for example, in order to simulate the amount of energy required to get that amount of sediment in, you know, he didn't know whether or not this was possible or if it was even accurate, but there had to be a body the size of the moon that had a close encounter, if you will, with Earth, not crashing into the Earth, but close enough to cause tidal waves across the globe. And his initial calculations showed that you could have with an object like that size, of course, you know, the closer you get it, but the greater the tidal wave, or you could have a bigger body that is further away and still cause the same amount of tidal disruption. But at least his initial simulations showed that tidal waves could be created up to 8,000 feet in height. Now, we don't even have we can't even think of a mass of water that, you know, that high and how destructive that would be. But those were, some of the things that...
So are they saying that there was an object that passed by, or they're saying that this is just a way to evaluate the energy level?
Yes, this was a way to say, well, if you had, and it was, like I said, it was just it's just a model. I mean, it's, it's anybody's guess as to what really caused that massive amount of energy, but you needed a large amount of energy to cause the cavitation in the rocks that were seen in order to cause the amount of sediment that is deposited around the world. And so he was just saying, well, if we had an object the size of a moon and, you know, so far away from the Earth causing these tidal events, what would that look like as far as the sediment deposit? And he got plenty of sediment deposit with that type of...
What he's really describing are possible ways that God could have brought this about.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
And that, he's not saying that this is the way it happened. Mm-hmm. It's just... I'm looking at what the result is and trying to figure out how much force is needed, how much energy is needed in order to cause that, you know, that event. But it was the conclusions that you can draw from that is, well, whatever it was, it apparently happened six times.
Six times.
Period of time, because there we have six different sediment layers, major sediment layers. Around the Earth that you can see, and so the conclusion was, well, you know, whatever this was a massive event and happened, multiple times
within a short time span.
Period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what other subjects were covered besides the flood? Then I know dinosaurs were touched on.
Dinosaurs were touched on. We talked. I don't know if we talked about soft issue that...
Mike Armitage, yeah, we've been in touch with him, haven't heard back from him. Hopefully he'll be joining us in an on-air conversation soon here in the next couple of weeks. In fact, I'm thinking, I know he's on the West Coast, and it would be 6 o'clock in the morning for him. We can certainly move that if it's okay with you, too, to an hour later.
And so I won't really talk a lot about his with the anticipation.
But just generally, he had uncovered the horn of a Triceratops, just short of 4 feet long. Took it back to his lab at Cal State Northridge in California and found soft tissue there. The question being, how can soft, you know, the presumption is that this thing is 65 million years old. How could there be any remnant of soft tissue if it was really that old?
Exactly. And a lot of, discussion has been going on about this. He's not the first to find soft tissue.
No, when we talked about it earlier from another source, it was reported at a conference in the Philippines just a few months ago, I guess. But somehow the major scientific journals never picked it up.
Somehow.
So, well, we'll delve into that in a couple of weeks. So I don't want to kind of intrude on that. But so floods and dinosaurs, what else of interest?
Well, Russ Humphreys talked about dynamo theories with regard to trying to generate the electromagnetic field that's around the Earth. Now, the electromagnetic field, for an audience that may not be up on this, our electromagnetic field is degrading and has been degrading, for some time. So you can plot the electromagnetic field energy over a period of time and see that it's been degrading exponentially. And if you go back and calculate, well, based on this exponential decay of our electromagnetic field, when would the electromagnetic field be so intense that life couldn't be supported? And that number turns out to be about 10,000 years or less. And so it's a good
model. So they're projecting from now 10,000 years in the future and suggesting that in 10,000 years it will be too weak to support life.
No, projecting backwards.
Because okay.
Is degenerating 10,000 years from now. There's not going to be much field at all. Uh-huh. But going backwards, you see you can only have so much electromagnetic field left. I mean, that living.
So what this is suggesting is that the Earth is not older than 10,000 years, or we'd all be gone.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Well, there would be no life, even as young as 10,000 years ago. But Russ Humphreys was actually reporting on was the failures of science to explain how the magnetic field is generated and how it could have gotten started and what's keeping it going. And so there's been dynamo theories basically saying that, oh, there's various events that causes the magma flow to either change or increase, and those would cause an increase in the magnetic field. And he went through a number of examples, and basically his conclusion was from his calculations was dynamo theories are just not going to explain why we have a magnetic field to begin with.
What causes it? Is it simply the mass of the Earth, or is it the particular kind of mass?
Well, it's the flow in the magma that is causing the magnetic field.
Movement of metallic elements, then.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And the type of flow in under the crust, basically, that is causing the magnetic field. And we can see through volcanic rock and iron that has been solidified, obviously, through volcanoes and through the lava and stuff, that in the past the magnetic field has reversed several times. And that can happen if the flow in the magma, for example, reverses, and which then causes other events. So that can be explained, but if you're not looking at the polarity of the magnetic field, but if you're looking at the total energy, it's the total energy that is decaying, decaying with time.
Does the shift in polarity affect us in some way?
It doesn't appear to affect us. And it happens from time to time, but it really doesn't seem to affect life.
I think it makes David a little ornery, though, when that happens. A little testy when his polls reverse, yeah.
That's got something to do with Skype.
Yeah, communications woes this morning. I apologize to listeners, too. It's less than ideal today. It really is.
Don, there was something recent that happened on the sun that had to do with reverse polarities or shifting polarities.
Polarity, the magnetic field on the sun is shifting, and it did. It's in the process of flipping poles. So it'll probably cause some maybe a change in sunspots or something, but it's not going to have a major effect on us or on the sun.
Mm-hmm. Can that same kind of thing happen on Earth too, or has it happened in the past?
Oh, it has happened. Yeah, the magnetic field has changed polarities in the past. Absolutely, and we have evidence of that.
And what's the evidence of it?
It's in volcanic rock. You can find, layers of volcanic rock where the polarity is one way, and then it switches, to the other way, in various layers. So there's good solid evidence that this has happened on Earth in the past.
We've talked a number of times about how the Earth is self-healing. And self-stabilizing. It always seeks equilibrium. So when things go haywire in one direction, there's always, it seems, a countervailing force. We talked about how it recycles carbon, and these changes in polarity, you figure they've got to have a purpose. And it's just that, is there any kind of ramification to a change in polarity? I mean, it must do something to something.
Yeah, apparently not. And even when we lose, when we lose our electromagnetic field, or it diminishes, so it's no longer, effective. What it's doing now is some of the, it's directing some of the energy from the sun to the poles, and that's why we have the aurora borealis, for example, because it's.
So, is it protecting us from radiation from space?
Well, it is protecting us from some radiation, from space. So, radiation, without the electromagnetic field would obviously hit us, and in the future we may get more cancer from it. But it's part of Earth and part of the natural process now.
Yeah, but if it can get weak enough so that life is no longer supported, it's critical.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I think life will, Earth will, unlike the reversal where you've got so much magnetic field that it starts disrupting biological functions, it would be, it'd be like, being in a super magnet, an NMR and just trying to live in an NMR, for example, taking magnetic imaging, constantly, that would have an effect on your body, ultimately.
Well, it sounds like it was a fascinating conference. Lots of areas covered. Any others we can hit on? We've talked about briefly about dinosaurs. We'll get back to that in a week or two. Hopefully, Mike Armitage, the scientist from Cal State Northridge, will be joining us. We're working on that. We've talked about the flood, and what other areas did they delve into?
Well, there was a paper that was presented comparing chimpanzee DNA to human DNA, and looking at the homology, or how much similarity there is between the two DNA. And what you would find, at least early on in this type of research, what you heard was, 98.5% of the chimpanzee is homologous with human DNA, and so therefore, yes, it's obvious that we, evolved from a chimpanzee. Mm-hmm. And that's the way they did their studies, was they they The early studies were done by doing some hybridization or, you know, conjugation of the chimpanzee with the human DNA and seeing how much, you know, stuck. And then they used the ones that were stuck and compared them together. So it was highly biased for the DNA sequences that already are similar between the human and the chimp.
In other words, it was engineered to prove a point.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what this study did was a little less biased than that. And actually, the researcher, they actually compared DNA sequences. Now that we have the human genome, I think they compared like 40,000 DNA segments from the chimp with our human DNA, and, you know, found under the best case scenario that, well, maybe 70% of that DNA is homologous. They have some sections.
Homologous meaning the same?
The same, but it's a fairly complex, you know, picture, because when they say the same, you have to set what sameness means. Mm-hmm. You can't just take a gene, for example, and compare one gene to another, because then you wouldn't get any match. So you have to say, well, let's just look at little segments of DNA and see, you know, if those pair up with anything. And this is all done now by computers, since we know the DNA sequence of the humans, and we know a lot of the DNA sequence of the chimp. And so he did this, and he looked at 250 base pair, you know, segments. Well, that's a short segment when you're talking about a gene, because genes are thousands of base pairs, you know, in length. And so this was only a fraction of a of an actual gene. And when they did it, he found, you know, 70%. And then he thought his sample was a random sample from the chimp, and it turned out to be, well, no, those are the ones that are similar to humans.
Uh-huh.
So already he's starting with similar.
So it's a database someplace he starts working with, not actual chimps.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, DNA, you know, databases that you can have access to. So his initial sample was biased. And then when you consider, well, there's a whole section of chimp DNA that is not homologous or is not the same as human DNA. And then there's a whole section of human DNA that is not similar to chimp DNA. So the bottom line is that humans and chimps, while they may have some segments in common, they are nowhere, you know, near similar. So the original conclusion that 98.5% of the DNA is similar is completely bogus, and has been, you know, proven that is not the case, and we are indeed different from chimps. And if we did this analysis with other animals and other things, we would find that, gee, we are completely different than everything else.
So then it's not true that if you had a gazillion chimpanzees all typing at the same time, that sooner or later they would produce the works of Shakespeare. It would be more like a dime novel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. No, that's not.
Okay. Gotcha.
The old random theory is not, you know, just given enough time, you're gonna come up with, you know, works of art is just not the case.
Well, it sounds like your week in Pittsburgh was well spent, well worth the time.
Oh, it was. And there's a lot of, yeah, there were a lot of good papers that were presented. There was a panel, for example, that was a panel on meteorites and meteoric impacts on celestial objects, and why we have a lack of meteor impacts here on the Earth. I mean, compared to the Moon, for example, that's a lot. And so there was a lot of discussion about that. Nothing real definitive, other than, you know, speculation as to why we don't have the impacts that the moon has and the other planets in our solar system.
Isn't that just a matter of atmosphere, though?
No, it's not. I mean, for the smaller ones, yeah, our atmosphere protects us. The moon doesn't have an atmosphere, but the moon has some tremendous craters on it, and we don't have those impacts of that size. I mean, there have been some significant craters that hit the Earth. And one theory, actually, for what started the flood was a meteor impact, but the meteor would have had to be so large that it would have vaporized the ocean, and we wouldn't have any ocean today, so that couldn't have possibly happened. So something was protecting the Earth at the time when all of these, when most of the meteors were having an impact on the rest of the solar system.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting stuff. Don Clark, again, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and our resident biochemist, and we're grateful for your input, your thoughts on this, and looking forward to getting into dinosaur soft tissue, hopefully in a couple of weeks. So we'll be in touch with Mike Armitage and see if we can get that set up. Don, anything else you want to cover, or David, any questions before we wrap up?
One of the thoughts that I had, or one of the questions. Now there's the 50th anniversary of Creation Moments is going to hold a luncheon on the September 7th. Is there any connection between the organizations, or it's not the same organization as the one that held the conference in Pittsburgh, but are they allied somehow?
Only through relationships. I mean, there is no, some folks are, I met a fellow, actually the son of the originator of the Creation Fellowship that actually puts on these conferences, and he did some writing for was Bible Science News at the time when he did that. So we kind of had a connection that he wrote for Bible Science News, which is now Creation Moments, so some of the there is some cross pollination between the organizations.
Okay. We'll talk more about the Creation Moments activity or the special luncheon, the 50th anniversary celebration, later on. Perhaps not today, but in the near future. I'm told it's open to the public. You have to just reserve a seat ahead of time, and you can do that on the website. I think that's creationmoments.org?
.com, yeah.
Is it .com? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's .org too, but it's .com. Creationmoments.com.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, we've got a link to creationmoments.com, of course, on our Broken Road Radio site, and you're welcome to go directly there and find out the scoop on that 50th anniversary celebration, conference, and luncheon. It's coming up on a Saturday, September 7th, in Roseville, which is right near St. Paul here in Minnesota. So we'll look forward to that, and we'll be there. And Don, we'll look forward to seeing you there as well. And also look forward to talking to you next week, okay?
Okay, sounds good. It was good talking with you all today.
Don, thanks so much. It's a delight as always. 20 minutes now before the hour, and Wes King sings for us. Follow the fisher.